On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Verizon fights dirty, and everything about Metasploit you ever wanted to know, but were afraid to ask. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twiet.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 59, recorded September 23rd, 2013. Armitage, Cobalt Strike, and Metasploit. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by OmniAlert. OmniAlert's mass notification platform allows you to instantly send text messages, emails, and more to your entire organization. For a 2-week free trial and 20% off your first year of service, visit OmniAlert.com/twit and use the offer code TWIET. And by GoToMeeting with HD Faces by Citrix, the powerfully simple way to meet and collaborate with coworkers and clients from anywhere. You can share the same screen and see each other face-to-face with HD video conferencing. Even present from your iPad. Sign up for your 30-day free trial today. Visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use promo code ENTERPRISE. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I'm not guiding you by myself. I've got a fantastic cast of characters, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the geek in paradise from his hollowed out volcano on the big island of Hawaii. No, I don't really know where you are. You're somewhere in Manoa. Brian, tell us how you're doing.
I'm actually got the Twiet logo right over my face, so I'm not sure what's going on. But anyway, be that as it may, I am having all kinds of fun learning about Windows printing and how it works, what works and what doesn't. And hopefully we'll have a future topic for an episode on printer logic.
I'm all about printer logic. But I also like another kind of logic. That's the East Coast, you know, the right coast logic. Coming from our esteemed colleague, Mr. Curtis Franklin from Enterprise Efficiency. Curtis, how are you doing?
I'm doing just fine, Padre. It's great to be here on Twiet. I want to apologize to all of our video viewers. The office is a little bit of a mess. We're doing some renovation around the house, and my office is the storeroom for everything that's getting moved around. That's it. But it is a great week. I've got 4 episodes of E2 Radio coming up on Tuesday through Friday, and then getting ready to cover the big Interop conference next week in New York. I won't be there. I'll have to depend on wonderful people like you to tell me what's going on at the Jacob Javits Center.
I'll be your eyes and your ears as long as you stick with me through an enterprise bite. Let's kick it off with what I think is one of the most interesting stories of the past week, and it involves our very own Jeff Jarvis. So last week, Jeff was very excited to get his brand spanking new next generation Nexus 7 with LTE. Now, this is the version that can work on T-Mobile, on Verizon, and on AT&T. That's actually pretty cool. So he walks into the Verizon store with his brand new device, and he decides he wants a data plan, knowing full well that Verizon is more expensive than T-Mobile, but at least wanting to be able to write about the experience of getting Verizon LTE on a device that can support so many different carriers. What happens next leads into a Jeff Jarvis rant, and you can find it on the web, but I'm not going to cover it here other than to say that essentially the people inside the Verizon store told him, "I'm sorry, we can't activate this device." Now, Jeff, of course, being Jeff, he goes on the web and he finds stories of people saying they pulled out their SIM from their other data device, plugged it into the LTE port of the Nexus 7, and were able to get Verizon service up and running full speed, no problem.
they still continue, you know, calling up their supervisors and their supervisors' supervisors and saying that this device has not yet been certified for use on the Verizon network. Therefore, we can't activate it for you. Now, before we go too much deeper into the problem, I just want to get some first responses. Chibert, what does this strike you as? I mean, we know this device works. It's really, really popular. It's already activated on two other carriers with no problem. And then you go into a Verizon store and they tell you, maybe not.
It's politics is normal. Verizon is a massive, massive corporation that has some bureaucratic inertia involved. And there's probably a bunch of lawyers saying, well, we don't have the dotted I's and crossed T's yet, so we can't activate. Yeah, sure. Technologically, this is a no-brainer. This is a political issue, pure and simple.
Right, right. Curtis, let me throw over to you, because one of the enterprise angles on this is that I think this is the future of devices, one device that can work on every carrier. I mean, we're heading into that direction because the devices have become commodity items and the carriers have become commodity items. I just need my device and a way to connect it to the network. So now that you've got Verizon essentially saying, we would prefer that you buy the devices that we're selling you and we would prefer you to buy them from us, what ramifications does that have for an enterprise market that is now accustomed to BYOD, not as an exception, but as the rule?
Well, I think the biggest impact that it has on the enterprise from a BYOD perspective is that it effectively limits the choices that that people can have on the devices they use. It's an interesting situation because let's remember that all of the cell carriers, all of the CLECs, all of the ILECs, all of those different organizations that provide bits and pieces of dial tone and service grew out of monopoly mindsets. They don't really like the idea that they're selling you product. They would much prefer it if it was in the old model where they just leased you the phone every month. The fact that they pretty much have to sell you a device they can bear as long as they're the ones selling you a device and you are captive to them for at least the life of that device and its contract. They are going to fight tooth and nail to make sure that anything that smacks of openness, anything that smacks of real choice for the consumer, is as difficult for the consumer to get as possible. This is the kind of example. Now, sooner or later, you know that they will, in fact, go ahead and activate the phone. But they're going to delay just as long as possible. And my guess is every time they throw a delay in there, they're going to offer a phone that's just as good as this one. It just happens to be locked to their network.
Right, right. Now, our international viewers are going to be a little puzzled because, well, of course, in most of the international markets, this is how it's worked forever, which is you buy your device, the device that you want, and then you bring it to the carrier of your choice and you have it activated. That's how the non-subsidized model works. Here in the United States, we are still kind of transitioning from the subsidized model where you would buy the handset at a major discount and then be locked to that carrier for 1, 2, 3 years. Now, here's where the problem happens. You may remember a few years back, 5 years ago, back in 2008, when there was a major spectrum auction. That's right. We stopped the broadcast of television on the 700 megahertz of spectrum wavelength, and we sold it off to carriers for many billions of dollars. Now, during that auction, which was auction number 73 on January 24th, 2008, there was a open access provision. And this is actually a fascinating story because during that auction, the FCC said, well, if the bidding gets to a certain amount of money, the open access provision will be added in to whoever finally wins it. Google bid $4.6 billion, which triggered the policies that demanded the open access of the eventual winner of the spectrum, Verizon. Now, that openness includes open applications, which is the ability to use any software, content, or service, open devices, which is the ability to use any handset device that you want, open services, the third-party reselling of spectrum, and open networks, the ability of third parties to interconnect at any technically feasible point. Here's the problem. This network access requirement for Block C that you can see up on the screen right now includes things like the use of devices and applications, which cannot be limited except for, number one, insofar as such use would not be compliant with published technical standards reasonably necessary for the management or protection of the licensed network, or number two, as required to comply with statute or applicable government regulations. So there's really not a whole lot of wriggle room for carriers to not open up the spectrum. That was one of the agreements when they actually bought it. Now, Chiebert, listening to this, it would seem as if the most wiggle room that Verizon would have would be in number one, if the device did not meet the published technical standards reasonably necessary for the management or protection of the licensed network. In other words, if Verizon were able to come back and say, look, we can show you, we can prove to you that the Nexus 7 destroys our network because it's using a really bad signaling method, then it would be okay for them to deny the device. But otherwise, they have to let it happen, right?
Yeah, pretty much. But probably what Verizon's doing here is saying, well, you know, nobody has proved to us that it's not going to destroy our network. So we're going to wait on this until we can prove it to ourselves. You know, it's a good device, but we don't trust you yet. And we're not going to let it play on our network until we know for sure it's not going to screw things up. It's the typical head in the sand type of mentality where, gee, I don't trust anyone. Who knows?
Good episode title, I don't trust anyone. Curtis, let me go over to you. So when we're talking about this spectrum, we're talking about an auction that Verizon won. They tried to fight the open access provision. When they bought it, they actually brought suit saying, look, this is non-constitutional. You can't sell this to us and then demand that we use it a certain way. They eventually dropped their lawsuit when it became clear that they were going to lose. Because, I mean, it's not as if the stipulation was a secret. It was stamped right on top of the auction saying, if it hits $4 billion, you're going to have to provide open access, just like you do if you're a telco and you have to allow other carriers to rent your last mile to get to the consumer. So does Verizon really have a leg to stand on here?
Oh, no. No, I don't think they do. What they're doing here is not so much deciding that they can win this. They're fighting a delaying action. They're hoping to make this so onerous a process to stretch it out for such a long time that most consumers will go ahead and out of frustration buy one of the devices that they offer that's locked to their network. Every time they can get someone to do that, they've won a particular victory. Now, sooner or later, the open devices will come in, but if they can push this off through another contract cycle, that buys them two more years of device subsidies, of locked devices, and opportunities to create captive customers that they wouldn't have if they just went ahead and went fully open today. This is a rear guard delaying tactic, and they see it being a winning one.
I want to talk about this delaying tactic idea because Verizon already fought a different battle, that much the same as they did with this when they were charging for tethering. The idea was, well, yeah, I'm sure you bought 5 gigabytes, but if you want to use it on another device, you're going to have to pay an extra fee, even though we're still pulling from the same amount of megabytes, the same amount of gigabytes per month. They were disallowed from that. The FCC came down on them and basically said, look, you can't charge people twice for the same amount of data. If you want to sell them more data that they can use on their mobile device, sure, that's a business plan, but we're not going to allow you to double dip. They ended up losing that and essentially giving the customer a much friendlier tethering agreement. If you look at Section C of the same language, the policy on network sharing, it specifically states in the last sentence, the potential for excessive bandwidth demand alone shall not constitute grounds for denying, limiting, or restricting access to the network. That was the line that eventually lost them the tethering lawsuit. And Chiebert, I want to throw this over to you. That should be the line that's going to lose them this action against the Nexus, right? Because we know that the Nexus 7 works on LTE. We've seen it. We know that it doesn't destroy the LTE network. So the only real objection Verizon can have is, well, you're going to be using up an awful lot of data, and that's going to mess up our network. with this provision, they can't use that as grounds for not certifying the Nexus 7, correct?
Correct. And just watch. I'll just bet you within the next couple of days, we're going to start seeing advertising campaigns from people like T-Mobile and AT&T saying, well, Verizon doesn't love you anymore. Come over and we'll give you some extra data. You know, hey, vote with your dollars. If Verizon's going to be a pill, don't swallow it. There's plenty of other goodness from different vendors all over the place.
Right.
You know, and besides, if there's enough people that really don't like this, I happen to have been one of the members of the Coalition for Competitive Telecommunications in Hawaii, and it was a committee, and we broke the Hawaiian telephone monopoly a full year before the feds did.
All with free markets. Curtis, let me throw over to you. I know you're a big fan of the free markets. You believe the free market will adjust, will fix things like this. What will it take? You just stated that every time someone looks at this and gives up and says, okay, I'll buy your device and be tethered for 2 years to your contract, that Verizon wins. What will it take? How many customers will it take saying, fine, I'm going to take my device and go over to T-Mobile, they're cheaper anyways, before Verizon finally says, okay, this is stupid, we're not going to block you in any future devices?
Oh, it's going to take an awful lot of customers to do that. I think what will finally push them over, as Chebert was talking about the other issues, when their marketing department looks at the numbers and convinces them that being open is a competitive advantage, that it's not just not losing them very many customers, but it's actively gaining them customers, that's when they'll go all in. It will probably take one of the smaller carriers doing it first, letting everybody look at what they're doing and seeing that it can be a workable model. Telephone companies of all stripes are very, very conservative organizations, especially compared to the IT world. They're going to make these changes as slowly as possible, and they are convinced down to the middle of their little corporate soul that they truly know what's best for the customers. They're going to have to be shown that that's not right, and that's going to take quite a lot of business decisions on the part of individual customers. We've got a while to wait on this one.
Yeah, I think so, too. I think we've got a while because it's going to take a long, long time. A lot of customers leaving, a lot of customers going for other options before some of the more established telcos realize it's not business as usual. Of course, we're going to keep following this story as it develops because it is important. You know, we've talked about BYOD, about bring your own device and how important it is to the enterprise today, where you've got people who just assume that the device that they have, that their device of choice, be it an Android device, an iPhone, whatever it might be, will work properly, and will work across networks. If Verizon gets away with this, we are going to start to see those walls go back up where they're going to say, well, if we could get away with this, let's see if we could increase our customer base by offering services that don't interoperate with the standards on the internet. That's why this is so important to us. Now, I do want to cover one more enterprise bite. It's kind of sad. I don't want to spend too long of it on it because it is a little bit like beating a dead horse. And that is BlackBerry is to go private. That's right. We've heard from various news sources, this one from CNN, that the largest shareholder in BlackBerry, Fairfax Financial, which is an insurance company, wants to buy the company for $9 a share. And judging from the response, there's not a whole lot of people who are fighting against this because that's more value than they thought they could get out of BlackBerry. That places the value of the company at about $4.7 billion. And yes, this does follow the absolutely disastrous release of BBM, BlackBerry Messenger, over the weekend, where it was supposed to roll out for the iPhone and for the Android platforms, but it was halted because BlackBerry servers crumbled. Curtis, let me throw this over to you first. This is a sad story because BlackBerry really did have market dominance. I mean, they were the enterprise player. They provided a secure platform, decent software, a good communication solution, and then they lost it really, really quickly. What exactly happened there?
I think that what happened was that RIM, BlackBerry, misjudged the market in a couple of important ways. One of them was that they thought that the corporate market and the consumer market were two entirely separate and distinct things, and that you could focus exclusively on one of those and just sort of live with the other. Now, that's possible, but they bet on the wrong market. They thought that by focusing exclusively on the enterprise, that they could continue to have enough enterprise customers to maintain a viable business presence. What they missed was the coming of BYOD and the fact that people were going to insist that they be able to use their consumer devices in the enterprise. Once the momentum had shifted in that direction, RIM BlackBerry was in a catch-up game, and they just never were quite nimble enough to make the transition.
Chibert, I want to give you the last word on this. You have a lot of experience with BlackBerries. You have a lot of experience setting up services for BlackBerries. I don't want to ask you, well, what is it going to take to save the company, or what kind of value is there in BlackBerry's IPO? Because, you know, there's so many other resources that you can go to that will talk about that ad nauseum. Rather, I want to go to you and say, looking at this purchase, looking at the fact that the company is worth $4.7 billion to Fairfax Financial, what would we hope would leak out to other platforms? You know, BBM, maybe it's not going to be the huge hit that saves the company, but it does offer value, right?
Yeah, okay. Sure. Their enterprise server product is really good. And my personal opinion is Microsoft, put them out of their misery, integrate it into Windows Mobile, and maybe you'll get some market share back, especially from the federal government and people that actually have to deal with regulatory issues in the BYOD market.
Yeah, I think that's really all we got. It's almost as if you're just saying, hey, Apple, hey, Google, hey, Microsoft, $4.7 billion is pocket change to you. Why not just pick this thing up? Now, when we come back, we're going to be talking all about pen testing. That's penetration testing. We're going to talk about what is involved in the practice, and then we're actually going to show you how to do it. That's right. You need to stay tabbed. But before that, I want to talk about our brand new sponsor, OmniAlert. Now, you may have seen once in a while a company, a government agency, a university use one of those mass messaging services where they try to reach 10, 20, 30, 50, 100,000 people at the same time. It's no easy feat. In fact, just over here in the East Bay, we've had a spectacular failure of several of these large messaging services that couldn't handle the load, which is why I'm really happy that we've brought OmniAlert on as a supporter of the Twilight Riot. You see, every organization needs an effective way to communicate during emergencies, during important situations. 7.5 million people in over 15,000 organizations have already found that OmniAlert is the perfect solution to their critical communications needs. OmniAlert's cloud-based platform enables managers to distribute simultaneous text messages, phone calls, emails, desktop alerts, and more. OmniAlert can even update web pages, social media, digital signage, and countless other devices or services. Organizations the world over have been able to fill their critical communications needs with OmniAlert, including hospitals, fire departments, and other emergency services, which use OmniAlert to replace one-way pagers, delivering critical information and summoning first responders. They've also been used by universities and colleges to report campus crimes and to notify students in case of emergencies. K-12 schools use the service for everything from automated attendance calls to reporting lockdowns and notifying parents about headlights and snow days. It's really that versatile. Everything from an emergency to, well, more of a medical urgency. Sports teams and community groups use it when they need to cancel and postpone events due to weather or other unforeseen circumstances. And companies, both large and small, use it to notify employees about everything from server downtime to local traffic conditions. Now, here's a few things about OmniAlert that you need to know. First, it can be administered from any desktop, smartphone, or tablet. There's no software to install. OmniAlert understands that you need to contact your person, your people, but you also need to keep their information safe and secure because their emergency contact information is sacred. They provide you with a 2048-bit SSL certificate, which makes sure that the interface stays safe. Their interface lets you import users easily, even letting them opt in via a text message, and you eliminate emotion and stress. You plan scenarios ahead of time, which means that when the time comes, you can deliver information with one click. You can trigger action sequences, including website updates, mass text messages, phone calls, social media calls, and conference calls, just to name a few. You can send messages to all users or set groups and select contact methods. Receive inbound tips and real-time reporting. OmniAlert invented the world's first campus emergency notification system, and it's the leading brand for colleges and universities, recognized as an industry leader by FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security. Their customers include American Red Cross, UNICEF, DuPont, Pratt & Whitney, Philips, Mazda, Bayer, Cal Poly, and even Petaluma High School Baseball. We've got it as a backup plan here at Twit Emergencies for emergencies in case our servers go down. In fact, this morning there was a traffic alert sent out to all Twit employees saying don't come up the 101. And over 98% of OmniAlert's customers renew their service each year, telling you that it's worth it. They offer hassle-free customer support, available 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and their prices start as low as $2 per person per month on the basic plan. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to experience OmniAlert's award-winning critical communication services for your organization. For a two-week risk-free trial and 20% off your first year of service, visit OmniAlert.com/twit and use the offer code TWIET. That's OmniAlert.com/twit and use the offer code TWIET. And we thank OmniAlert for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get back into the meat of things. We've brought on a super special guest, programmer extraordinaire Raphael Mudge from Strategic Cyber LLC. Raphael, thank you very much for coming on and talking to us. Will you explain to the Twit Riot, what your involvement has been in the security side / Metasploit side of programming?
Oh, sure. So I've been security for a while. I used to be active duty, and I was a researcher in the cyber operations area. After I left active duty, I got back involved in what I kind of consider the open pen testing community through an open source project called Armitage. And Armitage is a front end for another open source project called the Metasploit Framework. And Armitage makes it possible for a team of hackers to collaborate. So if Padre hacks into a system, Brian and myself, we can actually connect to the same server Padre's using and work against the compromised network at the same time.
Right, right. Now, I am sure that many of our audience have heard about Metasploit. It's been a buzzword. It's been out there. It's actually a very, very cool framework. But can you describe to the people who may not be in the know, what is Metasploit?
Oh, sure. The Metasploit framework is an open source collection of offensive capabilities, best known because it has over 1,000 vetted and safe exploits in it. And the project has been around since 2003. It was founded by H.D. Moore. And in 2009, the project was acquired by a company, Rapid7. And Rapid7 hired H.D. Moore and some of the core team, including Egypt and folks who came later like Todd Beardsley, and Sinner, which is kind of a funny name given the context, but they hired the core team. They continue to develop the Metasploit framework, and it continues to receive contributions from all over the security community at a breakneck pace.
Okay. Now let's get into it. We're talking about pen testing. Now, we know that's penetration testing. We know that's typically testing the defenses of any particular system. But can you explain in more layman's terms, what is pen testing?
Okay, sure. So penetration testing fundamentally is testing your security by trying to break it. I mean, what better way to know if something does what you think it's going to do than to actually put it through a hard test? Say, okay, is my email anti-spam solution going to stop a phishing attack? Well, send a phishing attack, find out. Is my firewall, as it's configured, is it going to stop an attacker from communicating outside of my network from talking to their command control server? How do you test that? Well, use the tools that an attacker might use and actually see what it does. Test those assumptions. Don't assume you're safe. And that's fundamentally what a penetration test is supposed to do, is exercise your controls, test your assumptions, and let you know what problems you need to fix.
I like that, testing your assumptions. We spoke briefly recently, and you mentioned that there are actually two different types of pen testing. Do you want to describe those?
Absolutely. So penetration testing is a very overloaded term. It means a lot of different things depending on who you ask. On one hand, there's the vulnerability assessment crowd. There are people who will use a tool like Nessus or Nexpose to scan their enterprise, find vulnerabilities, and follow it up with an exploitation tool like the Metasploit Framework or Core Impact or Immunity Canvas, and actually test those vulnerabilities and say, can I exploit them? And that's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is actually attacking your network the way an adversary would, trying to go after data or something of meaning to the business and presenting how you did it. And that kind of assessment now is usually called a red team assessment. Although in the past, that was the original definition of penetration testing.
Right, right. Let me throw over to you, Chibert, because you've done work in pen testing. In fact, I believe your university has a brand new department that teaches students how to do pen testing. Pen testing isn't just a fun way to hack your way into a system, right? I mean, there are many projects that see pen testing as a crucial step to acceptance.
You bet. One thing that I really like about what Rafael is doing is a lot of the pen testing that I used to have to do for three-letter agencies, a lot of it was just manual. I just had to use one tool after another. I'd have lots and lots of windows open on lots of monitors and start, you know, end mapping, you know, trying to actually SSH into things, trying to bring up connections on different ports. What Metasploit has allowed me to do is now we can automate a lot of this. It's basically lowered the bar so that people can actually test their systems before they deploy and maybe have a good chance at surviving in the wild. And actually, the department that's going to be running those classes is actually out of my lab. And we actually have a cyber range set up where we can have sample corporations set up that we can then attack in safety and not screw anyone up.
Rafael, I want to go over to you because I'm watching our chat room scroll by. And rightfully so, there are some of our more experienced users who are saying, look, Metasploit is a script kiddie tool. Experienced hackers would never use Metasploit. No one worth their salt would ever, ever try Metasploit or admit that they used Armitage. So, I understand that. I understand that. There's that natural animosity of those who launch attacks that they can't write themselves. But, I mean, we're not debating that, right? We're not debating whether or not you're sophisticated enough to write your own attacks. We're talking about a framework that lets even the uninitiated test their systems against what they might actually experience in the real world.
Yeah, it would be fair to say that the Metasploit framework has really democratized.
It's made it a democracy. Let's just say that.
Exactly. Four score. No, the Metasploit framework, yeah, it really has put a lot of capability into people's hands. And it's funny that some folks in the chat room would say, I would never use the Metasploit framework. I'd love to know what they're using, because to develop an exploit from scratch, especially today, that is a lot of work. It takes, it can take a lot of time to weaponize a bug, as we say, and integrate it with a kit. If you're doing that for every engagement, for every application you encounter, I don't think you're giving your customers that much value. Using pre-made tools is a great way to allow you to focus on what you're good at, work on your secret sauce, but not reinvent the wheel that others have done pretty well.
Right. Okay, let's get back into it. What are typically the steps in pen testing? Let's say you sit down to a blank slate, you get a new assignment, someone says, here's a bank. What would be the things that you would be looking at when you think about putting that system security to the test?
Okay, so I have to caveat this because, as I said before, there are different kinds of penetration tests. So it all depends on the perspective of my target and what they want. But let's say I've been hired to do a red team assessment, okay? And the bank has said, we want you to try to get into one of our internal systems that we use to manipulate accounts. And I'm like, okay, fine. And I'm going to be double blind and I'm given a lot of time to do this, maybe even up to a year. And there are organizations that do pay for this kind of penetration testing. So What I would do is first, I would do what's called information gathering. I would hit LinkedIn. I would hit Google. I would become the stereotypical stalker in the basement trying to build a dossier on the organization and just understand it. Once I'm ready to actually try to use a get access, okay, work on an access vector, one of the most common ones is, of course, social engineering, spear phishing, right? I would start out with a slight phishing attack that actually sends a LinkedIn invitation to a few people. This is one of my favorite things to do. I send a LinkedIn invitation, and when somebody clicks, they end up visiting something I control called a system profiler. And I learn a lot about what they're using on their system, and then I direct them onto LinkedIn.com like nothing ever happened. With this reconnaissance out of the way, I like to stage a virtual machine that reflects my target's environment as much as possible. What version of Windows, which browser, which client-side applications they have, like Java, QuickTime, Adobe Reader, etc. And then I pick my attack. I decide what's going to work in that context, test it against a few defenses, pick the user I'm going to target from information gathering, fire it, and hope I get my foothold. And I try to leverage that foothold to get at what I'm after.
Right. Curtis, I'm going to throw over to you, because what Raphael is talking about is what a typical hacker, what a typical pen tester, I'm sorry, let's put it in white hat, gray hat terms, a pen tester would do when looking at getting into a system. These are all the different steps. However, from the executive side, which is who you deal with, the executives in the enterprise, that's all a foreign language. What does an executive want when they hire a firm to pen test their system?
Basically, when an executive signs the purchase order to go ahead and have a contract with a pen tester, what they want is for someone to come in and exercise their defenses so that their team can fix them. What they want at the end is an absolutely airtight defense system. Now, everyone in security knows that this is not rational, that there really isn't such thing as an airtight defense system. But what we can give them is something that is reasonably secure, that will pass regulatory and legal scrutiny, and that lets them sleep a little bit better at night, knowing that their systems have been exercised by someone who doesn't have a vested interest in seeing them succeed. So when we get down to it, what do they want? They want to sleep a little bit better at night because the weaknesses have been found and explained and been fixed.
Actually, I want to open this up between Curtis and Raphael, because we've just run into this interesting dichotomy between the pen tester and the IT management executive, the professional. Because the IT professional, of course, is going to want to secure a system, but he has a vested interest in having the pen tester fail. In other words, having the pen tester prove that his system is bulletproof. So, and Raphael, on your side, the engineer just wants to, he wants to complete his job. His mission is to find the weaknesses in the system, and typically those weaknesses are going to be in the users of the system, and that's why you typically start with a phishing attack. How do you make sure that tension, that inner tension of the manager wanting the pen tester to fail and the pen tester just wanting to do his job, make sure that it doesn't cancel out and just become an echo chamber of, yeah, I guess we're okay? Open question to the two of you.
Let me start. I've been there. So that's a tough one, and that really comes down to good client management skills on the part of the penetration tester, okay? Penetration tester really is the IT manager's best friend, because what we do, what I like to say is our product, is we motivate the organization to make the changes they need to improve their security. And we do that by demonstrating absolute business risk, something that matters to that executive. And by demonstrating that risk, we're able to be an advocate with the IT manager to say, hey, look, that thing your IT manager asked you to buy before, you really should do that. Or this painful policy that you don't want to do or back, you really might want to put that in place. And I'm an outside expert who just compromised something meaningful to you, telling you that that would help slow me down, contain me, or stop me altogether.
Right. Curtis, let me throw over to you now to respond. Because, in fact, there was just recently a story, I can't find it right now, that talked about how in a recent pen test, they were able to get a full 25% of the employees of a major company to release some piece of personal information that would have compromised the network had it been an actual phishing attack. What would it be like for an IT executive to order up a pen test, to write that PO, and then hear back, listen, I hate to tell you this, but your biggest problem is not hardware. Your biggest problem is not software. It's the fact that you haven't trained your employees enough to be able to survive a phishing attack.
Well, I think on the one hand, most IT people would be thrilled to hear that because it would tell them that they had done their core job right. And let's admit it, most IT folks think their core job revolves around hardware, software, systems. So anytime they hear that employees who aren't in the IT organization are the core of the problem, they're thrilled. On the other hand, what this does is point out the fact that to a growing extent in the enterprise, the IT department's job isn't just around hardware, software, and systems. Especially when it comes to security, IT must be involved with HR and with the line of business departments to make sure that employees are all trained. So this could, again, be a lever to use with those other departments, with HR, to say, see, we have proof that we've done our jobs with the hardware and software. Now we have to attack the problem with the people. You know, this is the sort of thing that when you put it in business terms, I like to think of pen testers as being like very aggressive auditors for the security functions within an enterprise. They come in, show you where your bookkeeping, as you will, is a little bit deficient, and you need to watch your processes, watch what you're doing before you put it out there for full scrutiny. If it's approached correctly and independently on the part of the pen testers, what the enterprise gets back is full of value and able to be acted upon before the bad guys can come in and make everyone look really bad.
Right. T-Bird, I want to go over to you because TV's Egon in the chat room is making me laugh. He talks about how social engineering pen testing is always fun. And one of the most recent developments has been the use of USB flash drives to penetrate a system. I'm sure Raphael could talk a little bit about this, where, hey, look, someone dropped a USB flash drive. Score for me. And next thing you know, you've plugged this into your system and you've launched an exploit that now compromises your system. You must see this at universities all the time, right? I mean, USB flash drives get passed around with assignments, with projects. And now we know that that can be a major vector of attack.
Yeah, actually, I want to give a shout out to Hack5 Darren over at the Hack5 Network, even though they're a competition. They have a device called a USB rubber ducky that literally can run scripts. It pretends it's actually a keyboard and will actually virtually type all kinds of stuff onto your machine. So keep in mind, as of Windows 8 and Server 2008, 100% of the commands capable of being run on that server are available in the command line. So you can do some really interesting things. Now, as far as social engineering, when we had our Cyber Range exercise, one of the guys actually had his girlfriend, and she was absolutely smoking hot. And she went around in some really skimpy outfits to try and distract the other teams so that other people can come behind her and shoulder surf. We even had a little R2-D2 running around the webcam as a distraction. Shoulder surfing and social engineering hacks are probably more effective, well, in my opinion, than a lot of technology hacks. You know, there's obviously vault weakness and so forth, but your weak point is almost always going to be your people. What did you miss? What mistakes have you made? How can they be exploited?
Right. Raphael, let me go to you to close out this segment. Really quickly, once you collected your data, once you find your points of vulnerability, what do you typically do with that? Do you just give that back to the enterprise and say, okay, these are all the holes we found, these are all the problems we found, these are the ways that we got into your system? Or is there some sort of analysis that you have to put together to recommend things that need to be changed?
Sure. This is the part where the pen tester gets to compose the great American novel, because our product is not our mastery of our tools or our knowledge of tricks. It's the report that we turn in at the end. So if somebody just gives you a report printed out by a tool, they're not doing their job. The value of a penetration tester is to take their actions, what they've seen, their adversary view of your network, and turn it into an analysis that says, hey, here's how I see you, and here's what I, putting my evil hat on, could do to you to do something, to get something that the attacker wants. That right. report is all important.
Absolutely. Oh, just as a quick teaser, what is it that you do at, I want to say Armitage, what has been your function as you develop Cobalt Strike?
Oh, sure. So I developed two things. Armitage is open source. I'm the developer of that. And Cobalt Strike is a tool I built for red teams to help them demonstrate risk and actually leverage a user's identity. So a lot of things, not just chasing vulnerabilities, but tools to allow a pen tester to function like a real attacker would. And Cobalt Strike is my commercial attack kit that I sell that builds on top of Armitage. But I'm the sole developer of both products.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking all about Armitage, about Cobalt Strike, when we come back from the break. But first, I wanted to welcome back an old friend into the Twilight Riot, and that's Citrix, and GoToMeeting with HD Faces. Now, it's one of the oddities about our tech-filled business world that the people that we work with the most are not always the people we see the most. Co-workers are always on the go, or they work from different offices. Clients are spread across the city, across the country, across the globe. Now, to work efficiently, you need to have a stronger connection to your team to build trust, to stay focused, to brainstorm, to solve problems. That's why we use GoToMeeting with HD Faces, the powerfully simple way to meet online and see each other face-to-face, no matter where you are in the world. Now, with GoToMeeting by Citrix, your team is just a click away. You can share the same screen to collaborate in real time, and making your online meeting an HD video conference is as easy as turning on your web camera. With HD resolution, it feels like you're in the same room, and you can launch or join a meeting from anywhere using your computer, your smartphone, or your tablet. You can even present from your iPad. Now, I'm not just a spokesperson for GoToMeeting. I am a customer. I use the software all the time. My work has me meeting with hundreds of coworkers and colleagues each month. Now, I used to jump into a plane every time I had a meeting because, well, that's the way that you got from place to place to get that actual FaceTime. I switched to GoToMeeting with HD Faces, and I tell you, I haven't looked back. Not only did it cut my travel time per month in half, but it allowed me to have more interaction with the people I needed to collaborate with the most. It saved my organization money, it saved me time, and it saved wear and tear on my sanity. I love GoToMeeting. It's so easy to use. And with HD Faces, it's just like meeting in person. The ability to see someone's face, that raised eyebrow, that smile or that frown that tells you that you need to go on or that you need to explain more. So here's what I want you to do. I want you to try GoToMeeting free. I want you to see if it's as good for you as it is for me. So try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. For this special offer, visit GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code ENTERPRISE. Remember, use the promo code ENTERPRISE. GoToMeeting, meeting is believing. And we thank Citrix for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back into it. My favorite part. We're actually going to demo what an attack looks like. Raphael, let me just turn this over to you. Show us the steps that you would go through in order to launch an attack using your framework.
Okay, sure. So we're going to use Armitage, which is my user interface, but the Metasploit framework, which of course is maintained mostly by Rapid7 and the Metasploit framework community. I have to emphasize that because they're my friends. So, Okay, so let's go ahead and turn on the screen sharing. There we go. And we're going to start out with what I like to call hacking circa 2003, okay? And this is the process a lot of folks are familiar with right now. And what we're going to do is using Armitage, we're going to kick off an Nmap scan against a target, which is going to tell us which services are open on the host that we scan. So I'm going to go ahead and put in the IP address of my target, press OK. And what you can see is that Armitage has opened up a tab and it's run the Metasploit Framework's db nmap command. And just as quick as that, although it's not normally all that fast, we have a scan of a what looks like a Windows XP system. Fascinating. So let's go ahead and right-click on this host, go to services, and we can see that there are three services open on this host. Now, if I'm experienced, I could just search for which exploit I might want to run and drag it onto this host and run it. But if I don't know which exploit to use, and for those unfamiliar, an exploit is a piece of software that takes advantage of a vulnerability in another piece of software to get you code execution. So if I don't know which exploit to use, I can go to attacks, find attacks, and Armitage will go through all of the Metasploit Framework's exploits, and it will build up a custom attack tree for each host based on its operating system and open service information. And this will allow us to actually narrow down our search for which exploit to try. So if I right-click and go to attack, you can see I have 8 total exploits, which is quite a reduction from the 1,000-plus exploits that come with the Metasploit Framework now. So I'm going to go ahead and select MS-0867 NetAPI, which is the quintessential demo exploit in the Metasploit Framework. It's very, very reliable against an unpatched Windows XP system. I'm going to press launch, and Armitage is going to open up a tab and execute the Metasploit Framework commands as if I typed them myself. And if we're successful, we get lightning bolts. When you see a host turn red with lightning bolts in Armitage, that means the system is compromised. Okay? So if we can go ahead and show the whole screen again. Thank you. You can see that the host is compromised. And if I right-click, I have a new menu there. The menu is for Meterpreter, which is a remote administration tool built into the Metasploit Framework. It's very, very powerful. And I'm going to go ahead and select, let's see, I can go to a command shell. And Armitage is going to open up a tab with a command shell on the system. And I can now type commands on that system as if I were sitting there. I can also, let's see, a right-click, Meterpreter, explore screenshot. And I can grab a screenshot, see what the user's doing. Okay, in this case, just a happy Windows XP system. I can also, let's see, I can go shopping and browse the file system if I like and see if anything catches my interest and grab it, which is important for demonstrating that business risk. Something else I can do, if I go to access dump hashes LSAS method, I can get back the users who have accounts on that system and their encrypted passwords. But more significantly, if I go to Meterpreter access dump hashes wdigest, this will run a tool called Mimikatz, which is built into the Metasploit Framework now. And Mimikatz allows me to get back the plain text password of any user who has interactively logged into the system since last reboot. And this is important because once I have user's password, I can leverage that to try to get into their email or any kind of internal system that they might have access to, okay? So that's a little bit of a demonstration of Armitage. Now I'm going to switch gears and I'm going to go into Cobalt Strike and take you into a little bit more of a modern hacking context. So I'm going to close Armitage down. And let me just go ahead and start up Cobalt Strike here. And Cobalt Strike's product that I develop. And just give it a minute to start up.
Now, I should mention that the tools that you're showing us, these aren't new. I mean, people have been using Nmap forever to enumerate the ports that are open, the services that are available. You've just put everything into one nice, neat interface.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a good way to put it. So the Metasploit Framework is an awesome integration point for offensive capabilities. And that's what Metasploit gives us. It gives us the integration point, but it doesn't give us a workflow. So I wrote Armitage to help fill in that gap. And one of the emails complaints I get regularly about Armitage, though, is people say, Raf, I love Armitage. I ran an Nmap scan. I tried every exploit. I can't get into my Windows 7 system. I'll be like, well, running a remote exploit, a remote memory corruption exploit, is not how enterprises are attacked today. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit different. So I'm going to take you through kind of a quick demo of that.
Let's do that.
So we can go back. Yeah, let's do it. So the way modern systems are attacked is through what we call a client-side attack. A client-side attack is an exploit against an application used to view attacker-controlled content. So I'm going to start up a web drive-by attack. We're going to start up Cobalt Strike's Smart Applet attack. And what this attack does is it comes pre-bundled with several rewritten Java exploits to help them get past antivirus. And when it runs, it will actually try to disable the security sandbox and run my code as the attacker. So now that I've got a malicious applet on the web somewhere, I now need to clone a website and embed this applet into it, something to make it match my pretext. So let's go to attacks web drive-by clone site. And I'm going to clone twit.tv. And I'm going to select this smart applet attack. And let's go ahead and hit clone. And now I need to get my target to visit this website. One way I could get people to this website is I could say, hey, check out, I could post on Facebook or Twitter and say, hey, go to this website and check me out. I'm on This Week in Enterprise Tech Today. And if somebody clicks on that link, they're going to see what looks like the This Week in Tech website, you know, netcast from people you trust. And
trust us.
Yeah, exactly. Trust us, especially today, right? And if all goes well, we get lightning bolts. Remember, get lightning bolts, you're in. And we can see now that instead of a Windows XP system, we've just compromised a Windows 7 system, okay? And just like before, I'm going to grab a screenshot and let's see what the user's up to. And you can see they're looking at the This Week in Tech website, the one that executed our evil applet. Now, I'm going to show you something, Padre, I haven't shown anybody else. So I'm going to give a special preview to the This Week in Enterprise Tech website of something that's coming out in 1 week.
Ooh, okay. Yes, we like this.
Ooh, see, yes, this is fun. Okay, so my philosophy on hacking, I see exploits as useful tools to get a foothold, okay? But hacking is not the discovery and exploitation of vulnerabilities. Hacking, in my mind, is getting into a position where I can steal a user's identity and leverage that identity to get at the data that I'm after, okay? So with that in mind, I'd like to introduce you to something called browser pivoting. First things first, I'm going to go to Meterpreter Interact Desktop, and I'm going to pull up a tab with the user's desktop so we can see everything that they're doing, okay? And give it a moment because the actual VNC server needs to stage in memory and connect right. And all that. So here we can see the user's desktop now, right? And let's wait for them to go do something we're interested in, like access their email. So here we can see, conveniently, it looks like the user's going somewhere. And this is me, the attacker, watching. And oh, look, it looks like they're getting ready to log into their email. So I'm going to wait for the user to finish logging into their email. They don't know that we're on the system, that we're watching them. And they're going to hit sign in. And oh, snap, look at that. They're using two-factor authentication. Does that mean we, the attacker, are stopped? Does that mean we're out of the game? No.
Sadly, no.
And it's always very important to assume that if an attacker can get onto a system, they can do anything the user can. So the user just got their authentication code, and they're going to log in, assuming they typed their password correctly.
No.
I'll give it a moment. See? Oh, look, we're good. By we, I mean,
right,
the victim
right.
is good. Some, right?
Whoever that is. That.
Whoever. Mm-hmm. So we can see the user is in their email now, right? So what do we do as the attacker? Well, here's a tool I've been working on, and it's called browser pivoting. I'm going to right-click on this host, go to Meterpreter, Explore, Browser Pivot. And I'm going to inject myself as the attacker into the target's Internet Explorer. And let's see, I'm going to inject into, let's see here, not that one. I want to inject into this one. So let's go ahead and launch. And what this is going to do, it's going to create a proxy server that I, the attacker, can go through, tunneled through my remote administration tool. And this is going to allow me to access anything that the user is logged into. So if I go to, for example, Yahoo Mail in my browser as the attacker, oh, look, I'm in the user's email.
Now, let's make it clear. This is not an RDP exploit. You're actually using the browser process.
Yeah, I'm in their browser. I'm in my browser on my attacker system. Now I'm able to go through this web application that the user authenticated to without them knowing. I'm actually just, in the convenience of my own browser, going shopping.
And that's on their browser.
On their browser. Yeah, I'm making their browser fulfill requests for me. And this is a red teaming tool. The purpose is to demonstrate that I, as an attacker, can get at something that's meaningful to the business or leverage it to get closer to my goal. Maybe I could use the user's email to send another spear phishing attack to get at somebody else I want to get to, maybe their boss or somebody who's got access to the data that I want.
Right. I mean, just think about all the different websites that you leave yourself logged into on your browser. This essentially gives someone who has compromised your machine access to everything, your Amazon, your Netflix, your banking. It could all be right there. Now, you're kind of freaking out my chat room, so I want to put a little break in here. Several of them have asked, well, look, shouldn't someone be able to spot that their system has been compromised? I think that's one of the things that it's a myth, because unless someone's really paying attention to their resource usage, they wouldn't even know that someone else is using their processes, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So detecting an attacker just by gut feel alone is not possible. An attacker who has good tradecraft is going to be able to live in processes that you're running. One of my favorite things to do is to actually inject myself into network defense tools. I like to stay in the things that aren't going to close.
Oh, now that's just mean. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Now, look, you know what? I want to take a break again because the chat room is kind of freaked out. I want to talk about the last sponsor of the show, but then we are going to come back because I want to wrap this up and I want to get a couple of take-homes for engineers and for executives alike on where this data should be used and why they should be using these tools as often as possible. But before we get there, I want to take some time to talk all about RingCentral. Now, you know RingCentral. You know we love RingCentral. RingCentral, well, it gave to users the promise that Twit had been offering for so long, the promise of putting everything, all your services, all your important services into the cloud. When Leo built the brick house, he decided that he wanted us to dog food. He wanted us to do the same thing that we had been asking of our users and our listeners. And so we didn't want a big PBX system in the basement. And when Russell, our IT guy, said that we could get a cloud-based phone system through RingCentral, where, well, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. There are zero startup costs. There's no PBX hardware to install or maintain, no lines that run everywhere, and no specialized engineer training that we need in order to be able to manage our lines. Our producers get their voicemail through their email, and we can even get all our fax messages right on our smartphones. RingCentral also offers call functioning. You can program the order of devices that will ring when someone calls your number, like your desk phone, then your smartphone, so that you never miss an important business opportunity again. You can even choose the amount of rings before the call goes to the next device. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to see if RingCentral might be right for you and your business. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. One more time, just in case your system's been compromised by Metasploit, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com and the promo code TWIT. We thank RingCentral for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Curtis, I want to go over to you first. This is one of those things that if this demo gets shown to executives, they kind of freak out when they realize exactly how insecure their systems are. But I think it's a necessary evil, right? I mean, executives need to know that tools like this exist, that people like Raphael don't always have the best interest of the enterprise at heart, and that it can be as easy to exploit their system as a few clicks and a little bit of knowledge of how exploits work.
Well, I think this is one of those cases when the critical thing for the IT department is managing the expectation and knowledge of the corporate executives. If the corporate executives find out about all this as part of a conversation inaugurated by IT, where they say, this is why we need to spend the money on technology and training, then it can be very effective. If, on the other hand, IT has told the executives, we've got you covered, and then they see this, that's when there are problems. So the question is not just whether the executives find out about this information, but who is in charge of the discussion. I tell you, it had better be the IT group.
Yeah, yeah. Chibert, I want to throw over to you because we've got Scott Michaud in the chat room who he makes a really good point, and that is that people still tend to believe that attacks are designed to let them know. You know, it was the old 1980s, 1990s mindset that you would hack a system, you would deface it, you would put a message saying, hey, this is owned by Black or Padre SJ, whatever it might be. That's not the case anymore, right? I mean, when people are compromising a system, they're normally after something very specific, some sort of information, some sort of account, or access to the system so it can be used in, say, a bot network. So the old way of thinking about protecting your system after it's been attacked, after it's been compromised, that just doesn't work anymore, yes?
No, that's totally true. Actually, the acronym that we've used in the intelligence community, you know, when you start talking about why someone would commit treason or why someone would be a spy, it's called MICE, M-I-C-E, money, ideology, conscience, and ego. Those are the four driving forces that also work towards hackers. You know, where you deface a site, that's ego. But there's also money involved because people are going for credit cards, account numbers, and things like that. Conscience, maybe they're trying to go and shut down a site that's doing kiddie porn. Ideology, maybe they're trying to go and get a point across. Maybe they want out, you know, maybe they are willing to support Al-Qaeda and things like that. MICE is a very good checklist. It's kind of like when you write who, what, where, when, and how. Well, in the security world, it's MICE, money, ideology, conscience, and ego.
Right. Raphael, let me go back over to you. Would you recommend that IT managers have your tool running all the time in the background? I mean, it seems to me that unless you're running an exploit tool, some sort of framework to check all the systems that are within your subnet, you're being a little remiss in your duties, yes?
Okay, absolutely. So what I would answer to that is, first, what IT managers can do is they can do things like find the vulnerabilities in their enterprise, keep the software up to date, and try to execute on the basics. But as far as using hacking tools, they can also use hacking tools to test their assumptions, okay? For example, an IT department might say, we think our firewall is going to stop an attacker from even being able to leave our network. Test it. And that's where something like my tool can help. That said, tools like Cobalt Strike are very much built for advanced users, and there's a lot of tradecraft that goes into using a tool like Cobalt Strike properly. So I very much recommend that when you really want to test your security, bring an outside professional in to get that outsider's point of view.
Yeah. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you have done it again. You've used up an hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast this side of the Golden Gate Bridge. And I want to thank all of our panelists for coming on, especially you, Raphael. This has been fantastic. We're going to have you on again. Wonderful demo. And, you know, you scared the pants out of some of our chat room people, which is always a good thing. You know, you kind of you need a little bit of scare every once in a while to remember that you have to worry about security. Now, let me give you your time. We've got people in the chat room who want to know where they can find your tools, where they can download it, where they can start to watch videos on how to use them. So give us the lowdown on Armitage. Sorry. Why do I always want to call it Armitage? On Metasploit, tell us where they should go, who they should look for, what they should read.
Okay, absolutely. So, my dear friends, if you could put on my laptop screen over here, here we go. So, here's where to go next. First, the Linux distribution I'm using is Kali Linux. You can check out Kali. It has Armitage and the Metasploit framework set up for you at www.kali.org. If you want to learn more about Metasploit and what Rapid7's doing with it, with their Pro and Express products, go to www.metasploit.com. Armitage is open source and available for free. You can go to www.fastandeasyhacking to learn about it. And if you'd like to check out Cobalt Strike, including a free online 7-part course that is on the website, go to www.advancedpentest.com.
Fantastic, fantastic. And you personally, I know you have a Twitter account, and I think everyone in the Twilight Riot should follow you. Where can they find you?
Oh, sure. I'm on Twitter as Armitage Hacker.
Thank you. Raphael, thank you again. It's been fantastic having you on this week in Enterprise Tech. Cheever, let me go over to you because, you know, you're our favorite geek out in the islands. Tell us what you're working on, what people should notice. I know you're playing with a Nook box. So what's the Geek in Paradise working on?
Actually, the Geek in Paradise is actually building up a bigger cyber range, so that we have a nice teaching platform to work on. And we're going to be starting some every other week Saturday classes for the people here in Honolulu. We're going to be teaching about virtualization, workstation virtualization to start, and then the classes are going to fork and go into advanced virtualization and network intrinsics. And then it's also going to start into the Metasploit and Armitage fork so that people can learn about pen testing and becoming white hat experts.
Yes, we need more white hats. Now, a man who doesn't need any hats whatsoever is my good friend Curtis Franklin. Curtis, I know you're covering Interop. I know that you know, you're going to be geeking out with the rest of us at the Javits Center, even though you won't be there. I'll be your eyes and your ears. But tell us, where can they find your work, and what do they need to be listening to?
Well, we'd love it if the Twilight Riot would come our way over at enterpriseefficiency.com. We've got 4 big radio shows coming up this week, starting tomorrow and Wednesday with preview shows for Interop. Tomorrow, I've got the leader of the IT Transformation Institute. We're going to be talking about transformation in IT. Some of the things we discussed today will be there. Then Wednesday, I've got the chief data officer for the city of Philadelphia on at 2 p.m. Eastern time. Later this week, we're going to be previewing a conference that's happening sort of cohabiting with Interop, the Ethernet and Software-Defined Network Conference. That's going to be on Thursday. Friday, we're going to be talking about mindful management techniques with the CEO of Nimble CRM. Then next week, I'm going to have you as a guest on E2 Radio along with a bunch of other stuff. It's just an exciting time. I love being able to talk to all these executives about information that's great for the Twilight audience. We would really love to have you join us after, of course, you have spent time with Twilight.
Absolutely. It's a good time to be in the enterprise. Curtis, Raphael, Chibert, thank you, one. Thank you all for being on. You know who else I need to thank, though? I need to thank you. That's right. The person who's watching, the person who's listening. Because without you, well, we don't have a show. We do the show so that you can get the goodness that is Twilight. And so I want to give you a little something. I want to give you a way to get Twilight goodness into your device of choice each and every single week automatically. That's right. If you go to our show page at twit.tv/Twilight, you'll find a little drop-down menu that will give you all the different ways that you can get every episode, audio, video, high definition, standard definition, whatever you want, downloaded into your iPod, your iPad, your Android tablet, your Android phone, even your zombie Zune. We make it possible because, well, because we love you. Also, Did you know that we have a YouTube page? If you go to youtube.com/Twiat, you'll find not just all of our full episodes, but we upload the individual segments. That's right, stuff my IT guy says, the data closet, pro gear, pro tip, all the different bits and pieces that you need to keep up and current with what's going on in the enterprise. We give it to you in an easy-to-digest way. That's just one of the ways that Twiat says we love the Twiat Riot. Also, you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me, you'll find out what's going on every week on every episode of Twiat, and you'll be able to suggest, well, suggestions for future shows. In fact, this very show, talking about exploits, talking about Metasploit, came from a Twitter suggestion. That's just one of the ways that we respond to you because, again, we love you. Also, you may not know this, but we're live right now. That's right. Every Monday at noon Pacific time, I'm here in the Brick House in Petaluma broadcasting you the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe because, well, because we can. And as long as you're here watching us live, where you get to see how the sausage is made, you get to see the pre-show and the post-show and all the bloopers, why not jump into our chat room at irc.twit.tv, where you'll be able to talk to some of the most brilliant engineers, some of the funniest trolls, and yes, our super, super mods. Finally, I want to thank everyone here in the Brick House who made this show possible, to Karsten, my super producer, to Jason, my TD, who... Wait, Jason, I heard this rumor that you actually do the show that is something about Android. What's that thing called?
That's not a rumor. It's a fact. It's been proven a fact, actually, for the last couple of years, Father Robert, I'll have you know. And it's called All About Android.
All About Android. Yeah. That's it. It's all. Yeah, it's that always, one. Yeah, I missed that.
And it's twit.tv/AAA.
AAA, yes. Thanks to you out there. Thanks to CyberDog, who's currently in the Brick House, for helping us with the show notes. I'm Father Robert Ballester, reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise... just keep Twiat.